lecture in our classes in Christian ethics. And today, our lecturer needs no introduction to any American audience. And so, all I want to say about his coming today is that we are honored to have him and grateful for the opportunity to hear him speak to us today. I am aware of the fact that my classes in Christian ethics have grown considerably since yesterday. We had planned originally to meet in our regular classroom. Then we decided we would have to move to Gaines Hall. Then we decided we would have to go back to Norton Hall and in the famous map room. And when I got ready to come to class, I discovered it was over here in the chapel. And I can understand why. We're happy to have other classes joining us and professors who didn't get up their lectures for the day. We're also delighted to have the press with us. Also, I believe Frank Stanley Jr. is here. Editor of the Louisville Defender, and a moment ago, Ora Spade greeted me with Tavarish, and I said, Dobarusa. He is with Courier Journal. And I note among us also a number of the wives of the seminary students. Some of the faculty wives, we're delighted to have all of you, and we hope that this will prove to be a profitable hour. Now, all that is being said here is being recorded for some reason. I don't know why. I suppose we'll want to listen to all of this again later on, maybe in some of the other classes or in some of the meetings held here on the campus. I suggested to Dr. King that he make some preliminary remarks and then give opportunity to raise some questions. Now, the microphone is over here. If it's recorded, you'll have to come over to the microphone, I believe. We don't have one over here. So if you have, when you have a question, if you'll go over and raise the question here, you may have to come some distance, but I think it'd be well to do that. If you have a question, just line up there and raise the question. Dr. King will answer it. Now we'll have to leave, we will have to cease firing, thank you, in this class by 10 minutes of one so that the committee of the Faculty on Race Relations and Dr. King can go down to the mayor's luncheon. Dr. King, we're delighted to have you today. You come and take charge of this class.
Thank you very kindly, Dr. Barnett, and to the other faculty members who are here and to all of the members of the student body who are here. I'm very happy to have this privilege, and I want most of this period to be your period. You've heard me talk long enough. I happen to be a Baptist preacher, and I find it very difficult to control my time and face these time limits as I go around the country preaching. They often send me a letter saying you will have 20 minutes for the sermon, and of course I find it much more difficult to preach a 20-minute sermon than I do to preach an hour sermon. I have to prepare a little more to speak for 20 minutes, Sam, than an hour. You know that. But I'm sure you have questions that you would like to raise concerning the whole question of integration and desegregation, and also questions concerning the methods being used and the movement generally. And I would be very happy to try to answer them. I must say to you in advance that I have no pretense to omniscience. I don't know everything. And I can only say that I'll try to answer the questions that you raise as we go on in this common search for truth and this common search for a solution to this big problem. I would like to say just briefly something about the method that I have tried to advocate along with many, many other leaders in this struggle. There are three characteristic ways that oppressed people can deal with their oppression. Of course, one way is to acquiesce, to resign oneself to the fate of oppression. And this method has been used through history. You remember when Moses was leading the children of Israel out of Egypt toward the promised land, and they got out into the wilderness. There were some who wanted to go back to Egypt. They preferred the flesh parts of Egypt to the challenges ahead. I remember when I was coming up in Atlanta, there was a man who used to play a guitar, and he had favorite songs that he would sing. And one day, I discovered that he was singing a little song like this: "Been down so long that down don't bother me." Now, a lot of people get to this point. They achieve the freedom of exhaustion. And this is a... But, of course, this isn't the way, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. The second method that has been used is that of corroding hatred and physical violence. And of course, we know about this method. It has been something of the inseparable twin of Western materialism and the hallmark of its grandeur. And I would not say at all that violence has never worked in the sense that it has never brought about a temporary victory. I know that nations have often received independence through the use of violence, and it has worked temporarily. But I would go on to say that although it may bring about temporary victory, it never brings permanent peace. And violence ends up creating many more social problems than it solves. But there is a third way, namely nonviolent resistance. And this is a method which makes it possible for the individual to stand up against an unjust system, to resist that system, and yet not hate in the process and not use violence in the process. Now, there are many things that can be said for this method. First, it gives one the possibility of working for moral ends through moral means. And this is where nonviolent resistance would break with all of those systems that would argue that the end justifies the means. I remember some time ago when the student movement first started, a former president of the United States, the only thing he could say about it was that it was communist inspired. And I'm sure the students all over were very insulted by that. Number one, it's an insult on one's intelligence to say to him that if somebody is standing on his neck, he doesn't have the intelligence to rise up against this and protest unless Mr. Khrushchev of Russia comes over and tells him that somebody is standing on his neck. But the other reason is even more deeper than that, and that is that this is a spiritual movement. It has a spiritualistic worldview, rejecting the materialistic worldview of communism, and also rejecting the ethical relativism of communism. Lenin said on one occasion that any method is justifiable in order to bring about the classless society. So he says lying, deceit, violence, anything, just as long as it brings about the classless society that he talks about. But in the method of nonviolent resistance, when one is committed to it as a way of life, he does not succumb to the temptation of believing that immoral means can bring about moral ends, because he realizes that the end is pre-existent in the means. And the method of nonviolence makes it possible for one to seek to secure moral ends through moral means. It also makes it possible for one to struggle with determination to break down the unjust system and yet not defeat the individuals who may be caught up in that unjust system. So one who is committed to this method seeks to defeat segregation and not the segregationist. He seeks to convert the segregationist. And this is the tragedy of violence, you see. It seeks to annihilate the opponent rather than convert the opponent. Another thing about it is that it says that you must not only avoid external physical violence, but also internal violence of spirit. And this was something of the love ethic that I talked about this morning. And as you know, Mohandas K. Gandhi, who used this method in a magnificent way to free his people from the domination of the British Empire, was greatly influenced by the Sermon on the Mount. When he read the Sermon on the Mount, he said that this was one of the most moving experiences of his life, particularly the part that says, turn the other cheek, and the other resists not evil, resists the evil, not with evil, but with good. And these aspects and these teachings within the Sermon on the Mount greatly influenced Gandhi. And I do know, when we started our movement in Montgomery, Alabama, long before the people heard the name of Mohandas K. Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, they had heard of Christ. And we made it very clear that this was a movement of Christian love. This was a movement based on the Christian ethic of love. And this is why I say that our movement there received its spirit and its inspiration from Christ and its operational technique from Gandhi. So that it is very important, I think, to get over that when we get over the point that when we talk about nonviolence, we are not merely talking about something that was advocated and used by Gandhi of India, but also by Jesus of Nazareth. And I think this is a very important aspect of nonviolence. Now, nonviolence also says, and this is the final point I want to bring out, that there is an element of good. That is, that there are amazing potentialities for goodness within human nature. And that it is possible for human beings to be transformed. This is basic in nonviolence. Now, I don't think it is necessary to be superficial in one's optimism at this point. And I think at times those who have believed in nonviolence have been a little too superficial in their optimism concerning human nature. Man is not all good. There is some bad in him. Carlyle said on one occasion that there are heights in man which go up to the highest heaven and depths which go down to the lowest hell. For are not both heaven and hell made out of him, everlasting miracle and mystery that he is. And I think that is this aspect of man's nature that we must at least think about when we think of the nonviolent way. It's not enough to just say that man has potentialities for goodness. We must say man has potentialities for evil also, and be realistic in our anthropology. So I don't want to give anybody the impression that in order to believe in this philosophy of nonviolence, it is necessary to go to the extreme that even liberalism within Protestantism has often gone to, of seeing man evolving up some ladder of goodness that will finally be worked out in the long run of things. The fact is that we have too much evidence to refute this. But man does have potentialities for goodness, as well as potentialities for evil, and the nonviolent resistor believes that these things can be brought out, and that the image of God is not totally destroyed. Man is not totally depraved, although the image is terribly scarred. There is a possibility to transform human nature. And so these are just some of the things about the basic philosophy of nonviolence that I wanted to mention. Now, I'm sure that you would like to raise some questions about the more practical aspects of the technique itself and the rightness of this method and the practicality of it. So with these introductory remarks, I will turn it over to you to start firing the questions. Yes, on the first question, I don't know what will be done in Atlanta, whether this will be repeated in Atlanta. Up to now, it hasn't been discussed. I mean, it hasn't been definitely planned for May 17th. There is a possibility that something will be done on May 17th in Atlanta. However, on a larger scale, May 17th is a very significant day in the Negro community, as well as in the white community, for those who are allies in this struggle. And many demonstrations across the country take place on this day as a reminder to the nation that we have not fulfilled the American dream, we have not implemented the Supreme Court's decision. So that I'm sure there will be demonstrations in various sections of the country to dramatize this issue and the need to move on toward implementing the Supreme Court's decision. On the second point, we have sought conferences with many southern governors who have turned us down. I know in Alabama we sought conferences with Governor Patterson, who consistently turned us down. The same thing in Georgia. We've tried to see Governor Vandiver, and he has turned us down. I have not sought personally, and I can't speak for others, to discuss this matter with Senator Talmadge or Russell of Georgia, but we have contacted other senators, and there's always a convenient way to just turn Negro groups down when they seek conferences with the political leaders. Now, I would imagine that there would be a great difference here in border states, but even in the middle states. When I say middle states, I'm thinking of Tennessee, North Carolina, Texas, Florida, and Virginia. There would probably be no difficulty here. I think the governors of these states, on the whole, would see Negro leaders and talk with them about the problem, and probably the senators in these states. But in the Deep South, we do have this problem of the political leaders not being too open to conversations with Negro leaders. Now, on the third question concerning the efficacy, or rather the morality, of the boycott technique, I can only say that it is a matter of intent here. I have never seen the boycott as a violent method. Certainly those who use it are not participating in physical violence. It's not physical violence, so that automatically says it isn't violence in a physical sense. And we have always said that we shouldn't have any violence of spirit when we go into boycotts. We stress the need for loving and maintaining this understanding goodwill, so that the intent is not to destroy, not to put anybody out of business. The intent is to put justice in business and really to make a better business, because if these barriers are broken down, these merchants will make more money. And this is why I say it is a matter of intent. I have never seen it just as a negative, something that you do because you hate the merchant or you're trying to put him out of business, but it is a massive withdrawal of support from a system of evil in order to bring about some ultimate change and transformation, and certainly we hope we will convert some of the merchants in the process. It is non-cooperation with an unjust system, and certainly not any attempt to destroy the individuals who are caught up in this unjust system. Now, we know that some people, as a result of boycotts, suffer on both sides. In Atlanta, when we had the boycott, 300 and some people lost their jobs. They were coming to see me almost every day to help them get jobs. I mean, Negro people who worked at these lunch counters. And this is something of the risk and something of temporary sacrifice that you must go through in order to bring about the social change and transformation that we are seeking. But just to come back to this point, I don't think the boycott is fighting fire with fire, because the intention is not to defeat the merchant, not to put him out of business, but to make for a better business and to bring justice and freedom and human dignity into business, which will make for a better society for everybody. I could only say that there are two types of laws. There are just laws and there are unjust laws. I would be the first person to say to everybody, obey just laws. Now, that puts us into the position of asking, what are just laws and what are unjust laws? I would say that a just law is a law that squares with the moral law of the universe. A just law is a man-made law that is in line with what the religionists would call the law of God. Well, somebody would say, well, that's too abstract. That doesn't have any relevance in concrete terms. Well, what in the world do you mean by the law of God and the moral law? So you would have to move to something maybe in more concrete terms for some people. And I would certainly think that any law that degrades human personality is unjust from a moral point of view. But I would say, in just sheer practical terms, any law in which the majority imposes a code on the minority that it does not impose on itself is an unjust law. On the other hand, a just law is when the majority imposes a code on the minority that it imposes on itself. We can go on to say an unjust law is one in which the majority imposes a code on the minority that that minority had no part in creating or enacting, because that minority has no right to vote. So the legislatures of most of the states in the Deep South are not even democratically elected. And on the other hand, the just law would be the law in which you do have these things existing, where people have the right to vote, they're democratically elected, where the majority imposes a code on the minority that it imposes on itself. Now, after one clears this up, I think we see that you do have two types of laws here. You have just and unjust laws. I urge everybody to obey just laws. I also say that a Christian not only has a right but a responsibility to stand up against an unjust law. But now in doing this, he must do it peacefully, he must do it nonviolently, he must do it in a loving spirit, and he must be willing to accept the penalty. He must not seek to evade the law. He must not seek to subvert the law. He must do it openly. He must not seek to defy the law, because he becomes an anarchist then. But the individual who decides to break a law that conscience tells him is unjust and willingly, cheerfully, and voluntarily accepts the penalty is at that moment expressing the very highest respect for law. And he is not an anarchist, but he's expressing the very highest respect for law. Now, what we see in the Deep South today is not civil disobedience, but uncivil disobedience. It is defying the law. It is evading the law. And an unwillingness to accept the penalty. But he who is willing to do this and go to jail if necessary and stay there, in order to arouse the conscience of the community so that that unjust law will be altered and finally brought to the point that the law squares with the moral law, that person is expressing the very highest respect for law. Now, let me mention just a few instances of this. It's nothing new about it. There's nothing new about this. To a degree, academic freedom is a reality today because Socrates practiced civil disobedience. The early Christians mastered the art of civil disobedience. They did not obey the Roman law. They just refused. They were thrown to the lions for this. They would not bow down and worship the gods that the Roman Empire wanted them to worship. They were determined to worship Christ. And they disobeyed the law, and they were often killed for it. They were disobeying a law that conscience told them was unjust. Let us move on up to the modern day. Everything that Hitler did in Germany was legal, in quotes. Everything that the Hungarian freedom fighters did in Hungary was illegal, in quotes. It was a crime to aid and comfort the Jewish people during the days of Hitler. I believe that if I had lived in Germany, if I had the attitude that I have now, I would have disobeyed the law. I would have aided and comforted my Jewish brothers. In South Africa today, apartheid is the law of the land, and I would be the first person to say to the African people, if you can organize yourself to disobey the extreme laws of white supremacy in South Africa, you should do it. In our own history, the Boston Tea Party was a noble example of civil disobedience. The Underground Railroad, most of the abolitionists practiced civil disobedience. If I lived in a communist country today where certain Christian customs cannot take place in Christian worship, I would urge people to disobey the law where they couldn't have Christian baptism and they couldn't have Christian communion. I would just say disobey this law. So that I think that the students today, in disobeying laws that they know are unjust, are really in noble company. They are in the company of people throughout history. And this is the way I justify it, and this is my basic philosophy on it. Mm-hmm. No, I cannot conceive of a situation where it would be better to renounce the nonviolent method and turn to violence. Now, I have sense enough to know that there will be times that people, individuals, will renounce the nonviolent method and turn to violence. But still, I would have to say that I don't think it is the best method from a practical point of view or a moral point of view. I think it is both impractical and immoral. And even if it were expedient in a particular instance, I would still say that it would be morally wrong. So that I would be absolute in my position at this point in saying that violence is absolutely wrong in our struggle, morally wrong, and I think, as I said, I think it's impractical. And particularly in America, where we're seeking integration, integration is much more complex and even difficult than independence. Because in one instance, you are seeking to drive a foreign invader out. In the instance of our struggle in America, it's not driving a foreign invader out, but it's seeking a new level of creative life and existence with the very people that you're going to have to live with the very minute the struggle ends. You're going to have to live with these same people tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock as segregation ends at 8 o'clock tonight. Wherein in a colonial struggle, you are driving another force out that has dominated politically and otherwise. And I think in our situation, it is even more imperative to practice nonviolence because we have this job of living with the very people and being friends with the very people that we are struggling against at this time. Mm-hmm. You can be next, we'll say. Mm-hmm. I believe in the extreme of love, not the extreme of hate. I believe in the extreme of goodwill and not the extreme of ill will. I'm never worried about being an extremist. I think the world is in great need of extremists, and I say that very seriously. But the other thing that I would like to say in that context is that it is not... It is not right to equate the NAACP with the White Citizens Council. And I think this has too often been done. The NAACP has done nothing but work through the most dignified channels of legal democracy to make justice a reality for Negro people. It has not been an organization that advocated violence. It hasn't been an organization that advocated hatred. It has gone through the very dignified channels of the court to achieve citizenship rights for Negro people. The NAACP is seeking to live in line with the Constitution of the United States, is seeking to bring about the birth of justice, when the White Citizens Council, our councils, are standing against the Constitution of the United States. They are, through their vitriolic expressions, they are creating the atmosphere for violence. They would say that they don't advocate violence, but their defiance of the law and their words inevitably create the atmosphere for violence. So that they are seeking to prevent the birth of freedom and justice in society, wherein the NAACP is seeking in a very disciplined way to bring into being the fulfillment of the Constitution of the United States. And therefore, I don't think the two should be equated. I think one is in line with the highest traditions of our nation, wherein I think the other is out of line with all that is noble and all that is true in our democratic dream. And I would say that people of goodwill should join and should cooperate with the NAACP. I'm very proud to be a life member of the NAACP. I'm not an official of the organization, but I'm very proud of it, because I think the NAACP has done more than any other organization to receive citizenship rights for Negroes, and I think it has served as the one organization to keep Negroes from turning to some extreme group like the Muslims, or to some extreme philosophy of communism, or some foreign ideology. It's the one organization that reminded the Negro that he could achieve his rights and his justice through these channels, and it gave him a way out, wherein if he did not have something like this, he would have turned to communism and other systems and other forms of other methods, rather, that would have defeated in the long run the real democratic process. Gentleman in the back is next. Well, I would say that we must continue to condemn the philosophy of this movement, and all of the major Negro leaders do condemn the philosophy of the black nationalist movements generally. There are about five of them. We must condemn the philosophy and the fact that they too can create the atmosphere for violence and very bitter feelings. So on the one hand, we will continue, I'm sure, to condemn the basic philosophy. On the other hand, this movement came into being as a result of something. It is symptomatic of the frustrations, the discontent, the disappointment of Negro people. And while we condemn the philosophy, we must work with vigor and new determination to remove the conditions that brought such a movement into being. And that means the federal government must do this, our white people of goodwill must do this, and Negroes must do this. The other thing is this. It should also bring us to see now that the leaders that we've been calling extremists and the leaders that we've been, movements that we've been calling extremist movements, are really moderating influences within the Negro community. I know it's a difficult adjustment for some people to see the sit-ins serve as moderating influences, but it's one of the creative developments that people who have not seen a way out now see a way out nonviolently, and they've come to see that they don't have to hate to get free, and they don't have to use violence, so that it should help people of goodwill to support more these organizations and leaders that are guiding the Negro community into a channel of creative love and nonviolence and all of that. The other thing I'd like to say is that I don't believe that this movement will ever have any great growth or great gains in the Negro community. Right now, it isn't as large as we would think because we hear a lot about it. It's the kind of movement that will get a great deal of publicity anyway, no matter how small it is. But I don't believe that it will ever reach or influence the vast majority of Negroes. I think the predominant sentiment in the Negro community is opposed to this. We don't want to substitute one tyranny for another. We don't want to get away from one kind of segregation and get into another kind of segregation. They say that the most recent book out on this movement, and probably the most definitive, estimates the numbers at 100,000. The FBI estimates it at 60,000. Now, this sounds maybe large, but this is very small. When you think of the fact that you have more than 19 million Negroes in the United States, I can think of 10 Negro churches in the United States with 100,000 members. And so that this is not large when you think of the number. It shows that it has not had a great impact. And the thing that amazes me is not how many people they've appealed to or they've gained, but how many they haven't gained. So that I don't think it will ever have any impact in terms of large numbers of Negroes, but I do think it will continue to exist and will continue to appeal to certain people as long as the conditions of discrimination exist, as long as the Negro faces all of these economic injustices and the other problems that I mentioned this morning. On the first question, I would say that there is a distinction between private property that is purely private and private property that is privately owned but publicly used, publicly supported, publicly sustained. I think there's a great difference between the two. I think the anti-trespass law is all right, for instance, because I don't think anybody should have the right to just come in my house that I may privately own and not leave if I wanted them to leave. I think that that's a private right that we should certainly protect on the basis of the First Amendment to the Constitution. But now, if I turn my house into a store, if I turn it into a department store, if I turn it into a lunch counter or anything like that, then I have certain obligations to the public beyond my particular whims and caprices. For instance, if I deny, this is what was said in the Sherman Anti-Trespass Act, that if a business is in the public market, it cannot deny access. If it's in the public market, it cannot deny access to this public market. And I think the same thing applies here. It's one thing to say that you own that an individual owns a private piece of property, and another thing to say that this property is now private enterprise, where it is actually dependent on the public for its very survival. And this is why we feel very strong about this, that a man should not have the right to say that on the basis of color or religion, one cannot use a lunch counter that is open to everybody else in another racial group, but not to these particular people. He has an obligation to the public. Now, I certainly wouldn't mind if they had some stipulation that people drunk couldn't come there, that people disorderly in that sense but on the basis of race and religion, I don't think America will ever rise to its full maturity until all over this country we say that anybody who's in a public business cannot deny anybody on the basis of race or color access to that business. He should not have the freedom to choose his customers on the basis of race or religion. And I think this is really taking freedom too far. On the second point, I think it may be an economic risk. I don't know how great for a church to integrate. It may be an economic risk for a church where you have most of the people that are believing in segregation. On the other hand, I think we have another obligation. We are citizens of two worlds. Move on the basis of our commitment to the kingdom of God and not merely on the expedient, on the basis of the expedient, what happens to be expedient for the moment. And I think in the long run, even in these situations where there may be some economic losses, there is this great gain that comes from committing oneself to the basic precepts of the kingdom and committing oneself to the teachings of Jesus Christ. I think this is more important than thinking in terms of the economic side of it.
We regret that the time is up, and Dr. King, we express again our deep appreciation for your coming and lecturing to the class today. Thank you.